Hi, I'm Gordon Lamp here, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers who are shaping the real estate industry, and as a result, our world. Today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Andrew Weissman from Matthews Real Estate Investment Services. Andrew is an industrial outdoor storage, or IOS for short, expert, whose practice focuses on the southern United States. Podcast, he explains the factors that are driving the rise of IOS, the challenges and opportunities posed by increasing zoning regulations that are particularly affecting the asset class. Our conversation delves into market dynamics, profitability, investor appetite, cap rates, and the distinctions between Class A and Class C IOS properties. If you're interested in the IOS asset class, today's episode is well worth a listen.
Andrew, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Gordon, how are you doing today?
Good. So I think it's always particularly valuable when we reach out to folks that are experts in markets outside of our own. And before we start and we dig into IOS, which is one of the hottest asset classes in the market right now, how'd you get into the real estate game? Because that's always an interesting perspective into each guest that we have on.
Sure. I started in real estate back in 2013. I was in the multifamily business in Chicago, buying, you know, apartments for my family office. So I started on the principal side in Chicago and moved to the industrial sector 4 or 5 years after buying multifamily.
So two hot asset classes. What got you into industrial and then IOS?
So multifamily has a tendency to be very management intensive. I was looking to streamline our portfolio into easier managed assets like triple net lease, single tenant assets, such as you find in industrial. So I was trying to find assets like that outside of Cook County because we started getting hit with tax increases. So I started buying single tenant industrial assets in Wisconsin and in Indiana. And then in 2019, I came across a 10-acre site in Lansing, Michigan with 60,000 square feet. The two tenants at that facility were using the outdoor storage as a major component to their business.
And for somebody who's interested in IOS and industrial outdoor storage, kind of what has led to this rise of IOS and what's kind of the primary driver?
So the primary driver is just lack of supply due to zoning regulations. Each municipality has different zoning categories, but you know what is similar is that they all have restricted nature to them. I would take it back to, like, say the early 2000s when there was a lot of big box development going on throughout the United States. What occurred was is all these developers started buying land that was industrial zone, probably not taking into account whether it was like heavy, medium, or light industrial zoning. When that occurred, they were probably buying heavy industrial zoning, which primarily is the only zoning category in industrial that allows for outdoor storage as a use by right. And so that just created a lack of supply by the nature of big box development. And going further into that, I would say, as you're building more big box, there's going to be a higher demand for those complementary businesses that help build and manage those big box sites. You know, you take scissorless, for example. You always see scissorless being used at large big box industrial facilities. You know, think about like out in California, for instance, because of how restricted the zoning is out there, there are some municipalities that don't allow outdoor storage, but they allow big box. So think about trucking from 30 to 60 miles away to get a scissor lift. I mean, that's not really efficient, but that is going on today. And that's a major struggle for a lot of, you know, suppliers of equipment, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a strange reality. I know I've been talking with a lot of economic development folks in the last couple of weeks. It's kind of like a quarterly check-in. And one of the interesting things you find is that so many of them will see a site that's like truck storage and they'll say, oh my gosh, these people must be economically hurting. Look at all these trucks. And I'll say, you know, they might be on a beach somewhere. Like, this is a very different world than it was maybe in 1970 or 1980, where the junkyard or scrap or the trucking use might actually be the most profitable use that you can imagine in your community. I'm curious, what do you think is primarily driving that profitability for investors?
Well, I would say, first off, you got to think about it from the user perspective. So with the growth in e-commerce and in warehouse distribution, there's been a huge increase in the amount of truckers on the road today. They do say that 1 out of 13 truckers will have a place to park at the end of the night. And that's long haul truckers for that matter. So, you know, the Walmarts of the world, the Kmarts back in the day, I guess, the Targets, you used to see trucks parked in their parking lots all the time. As they've become more restrictive on who they allow on site, I think Walmart nationwide put it out that they no longer allow for truckers to park their trucks at night. And then, as you know, for safety purposes, you know, police force and state troopers, they're not allowing truckers to really park on the side of the road anymore. So what you've seen is not only from a state and national federal regulation, they're starting to build more truck parking facilities. But that's just like one component to the iOS game. You know, I would say maybe 10 to 15% of all iOS users are trucking related. And then you got to think about all of the other users, whether it be heavy equipment, whether it be waste management. Utility infrastructure companies is a huge user right now that has been very active, not just in DFW, but nationwide in taking up a lot of these iOS yards. Building supplies, you know, you have the ABCs, the Beacon or QXOs of the world, foundation building materials. You know, they need high quality sites. And I would say, you know, you talk about user demand. I just think as time has come on, the municipalities are starting to get a lot smarter about this, right? And you will see a lot of times that these municipalities were once allowing it, and you look at the zoning, like you said, you go look and you see this truck parking lot, but it might be commercially zoned, but they've been active there for 10 plus years. You know, sooner or later, when a truck leaves that yard, when there are no trucks, a lot of times they don't get that use any longer. And so that becomes more restrictive. So while you may be seeing a lot of, you know, users out there in the marketplace with older facilities, I mean, once those become vacant, they may no longer be applicable for this type of use going forward. And so that just keeps adding to the limitation of supply, because these users also, over time, like, you can go see a United Rentals, you know, location with a 14-foot clear height building, but they've been there for like 15, 20 years. They probably won't leave that site because they have that market covered, and they have so many different divisions in their business. They go throw a gen rent in there, probably not with a 14-foot there, but like a generator or a construction services, you know, types of their business that don't require big clear heights necessarily. But zoning is really first and foremost why the limit of supply is occurring, and you're seeing rental rates go up. I think a lot of these institutional groups and a lot of this big capital coming in from the Blackstones and the JP Morgans, the reason why they are so attractive to this today is probably just the mark-to-market opportunity, because it is such a fragmented market. You know, every day we're talking to owners of these sites that have owned these sites for 20 to 30 years. You know, they're probably using it for their own business. And you got to think about the generational turnover today. And I think that's another reason, is because you're seeing that opportunity for an individual to exit, make some pretty good money on selling this asset while a new owner can come in and lease this out at a pretty decent rate. And, you know, if it's not an owner user that's occupying the building, it could be an owner that's held this property for 20 years, and say it's a United rental that's been there for 15 or 20 years. They've probably had a 10-year lease at way below market rents with 2 5-year options that are only increasing between 2 to 3% a year for 15 to 20 years. So there's still that mark-to-market opportunity for these investors out there.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing, particularly one of the things you mentioned, which was the generational turnover. I know for us, we've seen a tremendous amount of that and a tremendous amount of opportunity on particularly Chicago's North Shore and some of the higher priced areas. A lot of users that are, you know, older junkyards, older scrap yards, older automotive uses that they're, you know, their kids aren't taking over the business and they're looking to sell. And some of them are sitting on a gold mine. But I'm curious how you see that play out in terms of kind of the shift over and kind of what you're seeing in markets across the board for how some of those communities are dealing with, well, maybe it's not an automotive user, but we have a new user that's coming in and maybe they're a landscaping company or somebody else who needs outdoor storage. How are communities perceiving that, and how can investors kind of understand how a change in ownership might affect the viability of a property?
Sure. You know, I dealt with this specifically a couple months ago in the San Antonio market, for example. There was an owner that had owned this asset for 15 years, had a single tenant in there for that whole time. That site itself, while it was zoned appropriately, that user, because it's been in there for such a long time, they didn't even have a certificate of occupancy on file. So, right. And so that buyer that came in, that bought a very aggressive cap rate, mind you, they, through their, you know, due diligence, they realized that there were certain aspects of the site that didn't meet today's code for improvement. And so they realized, okay, new fencing, higher fencing, landscape, you know, improvements, parking improvements. A lot of these sites will need improvement along the way. And I think that's something that investors today need to be very cognizant about, is that because of these assets, there is that mark-to-market story, and that's what everybody's chasing, right? But because these assets have been sitting occupied for a very long time, it might not meet today's standards per the municipality. And so that is something that people really need to be cognizant about. That's a very good point.
So one of the other things that I think we need to be cognizant about is what investor appetite actually looks like. I mean, it's great to sit there and say, well, there's a tremendous amount of potential in this asset class, but who is buying IOS today, and kind of how are those private and institutional capital inflows actually playing out in the market for that person who's listening, who's sitting on an IOS property?
Sure. You have private clients all the way up to the big institutional operators that are buying these assets. The big institutional players, their bread and butter would be to buy an asset that has that mark-to-market story that we've talked about, that has a smaller WALT period, you know, call it 3, no more than 5 years, where they can roll it into their fund and then sell it to that next buyer with the mark-to-market story. They will go buy stabilized assets because you're starting to see a lot of, you know, newer development or newer leases come out that will be a 5 to 10 year lease structure, where then it's really a cap rate type of buy, a stabilized buy, and you may not see those operators get as aggressive as maybe, say, a private client that is really wanting to roll that in for their cash flow, right, for income, where they may have even a 1031 asset that they're trying to trade out of, and they could go buy it at a more aggressive cap rate. I've seen quite a few deals, stabilized deals, that are trading between a 6.5 and a 7 cap with longer term WALTs. And typically that's going to be like a private client that's going to look at that as more like a retail buy than a traditional industrial buy, so to speak.
So what are kind of the market dynamics between maybe your traditional cap rate that you see for an industrial warehouse that's occupied versus maybe cap rate trends for IOS?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. Like right here, right now in Dallas, you're seeing cap rates for traditional industrial all around 5.5%. And I think that could be for any major metro, that could be the case for institutional quality assets. I would say today on stabilized portfolios, for example, you're seeing in the IOS space, I know a number of portfolios that have traded around a 5.8, call it, between a 5.5 and a 6 cap. And, you know, I think that's more due to the amount that investors are able to deploy. So take that and then look at a single asset. I think it's going to be a lot harder for a single asset to trade at those numbers than a portfolio. But I think later down the road, you will start seeing more cap rate compression as more and more people are trying to find this type of asset. You're going to see that cap rates are going to start getting more compressed just because of the lack of supply.
Why do you think that is, that there's a wider cap rate generally? One of the things that we found when we're trying to pitch investors in the Chicagoland or Wisconsin market is that they tend to see it as dirty, or they tend to see that there's all this risk and liability with trucks or outdoor storage in comparison to just your standard, you know, Class B, Class A warehouse. Is that what you're seeing in the market a little south of here, or, you know, what else is going on?
I think the reason why there's still a spread is because the lack of understanding and the lack of comps, you know, data. I think we're so early on, you're still trying to educate the lenders out there and the buyers, even for that matter. You know, a lot of these buyers are national buyers, and you have to educate them on the market, you know, and that's our job as brokers, is to provide them with that market data. I still think we're early on enough to where you're going to see that spread between traditional industrial and IOS, but I think that's quickly closing. And I think sooner or later, especially when you start seeing development occur, is when you're going to start seeing the institutionalization of this, and you're really going to start defining what is truly like a Class A IOS facility versus a B or a C. And you know, I will say this is a continuous discussion that we've been having in this asset class, is how do we get to a standardization of this? And, you know, it's hard to say right now, but as more data comes available, more buyers are out there, there's more larger transactions taking place, capital becoming more comfortable with lending on this and buying, you're going to start seeing that spread lessen for sure.
If you had to shoot from the hip and say, you know, what are some of the factors that you think are primarily, you know, the distinguishing marks between a Class A and Class C IOS property, what do you think those primary distinguishing marks would be?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I think about that differential, I look at it from a user standpoint. How are users going to pick one asset from another? Say it's in the same market, same acreage and square footage. What are the key attributes of these sites that make one better than another? You know, these users look at safety as a major component for picking a site. So they want to have easy access to these sites, usually they want two ingress egresses, two are coming out of the site. So they want good flow because a lot of these users have big troughs, right? So they need good turn radiuses and they need to be able to access at good speeds. I would say the type of stabilization on these yards is very important. I would say that's more municipality driven. But say, for instance, you have a forklift manufacturer that wants to store forklifts on site. If you've ever tried to drive a forklift on gravel or store them on gravel, you'll know that you'll sink very quickly. So you want concrete, right? Now, heavy equipment users, they may not need concrete on all of the yard, but around the building for, you know, use, that's going to be more beneficial. So stabilization, more concrete than gravel is probably preferred. Clear heights, door heights, office warehouse mix is important as well. Lighting and securitization too play a factor. So those are a lot of the key aspects of site selection that I'd look for. You know, you don't necessarily have to also be on highway frontage, but have accessibility to highway, I would say, is more important for these users than being on highway.
So, you know, besides, or maybe let's look at it as ultimately location is probably the greatest driver of value. And particular locations, we're seeing the greatest value potential in terms of potentially price increases. And a lot of that comes down to factors like constraints on the market. What markets do you think are most likely to see the greatest upside over maybe the next 5 or 10 years relative to maybe some markets where there's fewer supply constraints and maybe greater availability of locations?
Sure. I mean, DFW is a great example. You know, it's such a large market, but there's a lot of users in this market too. You're going to continue to see that generational shift occur and investors still looking into this market. You know, today you're looking on average 5,500 to 6,000 an acre for infill sites. It could even go up to 7,500 to, I leased the site for over 10,000 an acre, earlier this year. So I will say for smaller sites, you're starting to see that real rent appreciation where you're hitting close to 10,000 an acre per month for, you know, 1 to 3 acre sites. And then it gets watered down a little bit as the sites grow in size. But at the end of the day, you can only have so much rent appreciation as well, right? You know, users can only afford so much. And that's just a factor of, you know, every market for a user, say it's a national equipment group, for example, they will take every market and they will figure out what the market cap is for their industry in that market. They're going to then go in and they're going to say, okay, based on that market cap, how much market share can I get it? Okay. So then they're going to look at what their gross revenue will be for that one particular site. And most users look at sites as they're on their own little island from a revenue perspective. And so they're going to take that gross revenue and they multiply it by a rent factor on what they can afford. Typically, it's between 2 to 5% is what I've seen. And so that's how they dictate what they can afford and rent in that market. You know, a 5%, like say I was doing this math earlier today. So if they're saying that they can generate $7 million a year out of that one location, that their rent could be roughly around $30,000 a month, triple that. So that's kind of how we look at it and try to stay within that, because if you start backing that out and looking at market rents, it will actually be pretty spot on. So
those numbers aren't vastly different than what I would mark for the Chicago market. In terms of one of the things that I think is the greatest nuance, though, I see across the market differences between like Chicago and even the Wisconsin market that we serve, is kind of some of the operational nuances that are going on in terms of users. So what types of tenants and lease structures are you seeing on the rise? and kind of how are you seeing that play out in the Dallas market?
Yeah, I mean, so I do a lot of work in the equipment rental space, and construction is pretty rampant here. So you're seeing a lot of construction equipment users enter this market. I would also say that utility infrastructure companies are really big right now with data center development in core markets. I will say, like, spending time in Chicago, I will say that's a very core market. One of the things that I look into, and there's trends in the US that kind of follow this, is I follow highways and infrastructure. Chicago, you know, all the way down to Joliet, Bolingbrook, huge logistics corridors, right? You have great intermodals, you have inland ports, you have real water ports down in Joliet, right? And then you have the highway systems, you know, you have 80, 55, 94, all of those, right? So Chicago's is just a very good market. I would say the same thing for, say, Memphis, right? Say the same thing for Kansas City, same thing for DFW. I mean, not only private investment, but public investment dollars have gone into that. And that's a huge driver for all of this industrial outdoor storage. So I would say, from a market perspective, I look for those attributes in markets whenever I go looking for iOS sites, because I know there's going to be a constant demand because of that private public investment into those municipalities, into that market. So that's kind of how I differentiate markets. And, you know, you can do it by size, and a lot of investment groups do it by size. But I also take it a step further, and I look at the infrastructure that market has, you know, because no one looks at, say, Mobile, Alabama as a primary market. However, Walmart moved all of their freight from the West Coast to Mobile. So I would say that infrastructure in Mobile, that port infrastructure that they're continuing to grow in Mobile, makes that a very attractive market for iOS investors. Same thing with Savannah, same thing with a lot of the East Coast ports. You know, New Jersey has been, in New York, they've been large ports for a long time, but there's other ports that are opening up because of the transfer of business from the West Coast to the East Coast. So, I mean, it's a very fluid thing for sure, but I look at the infrastructure in place to determine a lot of that demand.
Yeah, infrastructure is, you know, ultimately a huge driver of iOS need. And as somebody who focuses on the Chicago market, I mean, yeah, there's no greater reason why Chicago has been able to weather just absolute mismanagement over the years and been still a financially sound, generally, economy.
Yeah.
I'm curious, though, you know, we have all sorts of risks that are associated with our business, and many real estate investors that I talk to, and I'm sure you'd say generally the same thing, are risk averse. That's one of the reasons why they're in real estate, that it's a less risky way to grow capital and family wealth. I'm curious where you see some of the biggest risk factors in iOS and potentially, you know, what risks to watch out for.
Sure. I would say, like, today, after 3 or 4 years of all this aggregation taking place, one of the things that I've started to notice is a lot of the market's already been covered once. Us brokers do a really good job going and canvassing markets and identifying opportunities for investors to aggregate. Being that this has gone on for a few years now, I'm seeing that a lot of these sites that are still available just don't work. They're not as functional as the ones that have already been acquired. So going into the next phase of this asset class would be development. And you're seeing a lot of development starting to take place. However, a lot of this development is taking place in the outskirts of that core. And they're trying to capture the growth into these new markets. And by doing that, these developers are going to start taking on considerable risk. Because while we have comps for that infill core market, you know, you're having to balance that yield on cost on a development by still taking into account what market rents are going to be. You're essentially going to be creating that market rent in these newer markets because you don't have existing uses there. And so that is going to be the greatest risk, I feel, in the next 3 to 4 years as this continues to grow, is the development risk. And I think we're all trying to figure that out now. But I think one of the things that we can use to kind of find that happy medium in rent is to go do your yield on cost metric, but then also talk with users in the market or who are wanting to be in that market and doing that arithmetic that we did earlier on how much they can afford based on what the market will give them from a revenue perspective.
Yeah, that's great advice. I know we've worked with a number of occupiers in the last 5 years that went out and bought sites and tried to get them zoned, and they're going further and further out into communities to try to make something work. And there's a lot of risk there. And then to do it right. From the investor side, one other thing I'd like to touch on is kind of what are you seeing in terms of operator risk? I know that, you know, there's potentially downside always with the economy and how it can affect trucking. Mm-hmm. Trucking is very economically sensitive, just like a lot of industries. And so how are you seeing that play out with tenant credit and kind of how folks are evaluating the evaluating what a good tenant is?
Yeah, I mean, so I would say the first part of this year, it was pretty slow from a tenant demand. Everybody was trying to figure out what these tariffs were going to bring. And so a lot of groups were pencils down. I think today you're seeing a lot more user activity and demand. So from an operator standpoint, you know, typically from a lease, you know, they're wanting 3 to 5 year leases at a minimum. They're definitely doing credit checks, seeing if they're financially stable to make these type of commitments. I would just say that they're looking to their overall business plan as well. I had one operator that asked the tenant for their 5 year, you know, business plan, and they were in the hardscape business, and they showed considerable growth because they're in a growth market where they're going to be able to really tackle all of this residential growth in that market. So it was a good business plan for that specific site. But they're definitely taking into account credit, the size of the business, how many employees they have, what kind of taxes they can pay, because they also need to get the municipality comfortable with the use. And if you can show that municipality the creditworthiness of the tenant, it will go a very long way with the municipality. I would say I'm dealing with this in 3 municipalities right now, trying to get COs for some users and showing the tenant's business plan, their expected annual revenue today and what it will be 5 years down the road will help you out tremendously with that municipality.
So before we get to our final four and we wrap up the podcast, there's one question I'd really like to ask, and it's for, you know, investors that are evaluating a deal. What do you think are the biggest things that they need to look at before putting their toe in the water? Because I know I have a lot of individuals that are on here as subscribers, and a lot of individuals that subscribe to our blog, our newsletter, that always ask about iOS and how they can look at an iOS deal because it's the hottest class, at least in Chicagoland, in many ways. Mm-hmm. What would be, if you have just a tidbit of advice for anybody who's looking?
First, look into the zoning. That's number one. The second thing I would advise on doing is looking at what market rents are, replacement rents. Because these tenants, while they have the tendency to be really sticky, the last thing you want to do is go try to find another user because your user moved out. So make sure your rents are at or below market. And then just functionality of the building long term. You know, over the years, I've seen where users, you know, 5 years ago were looking for 14-foot clear heights, and now it's minimum 20. You know, as these users' equipment and needs evolve, you know, those specifications for these sites get bigger. They do. So you want to make sure when you find an asset that you want to invest in, you need to make sure that there's, you know, this will be applicable for users 5 or 10 years down the road. Because that's how long these users want to be in these facilities too. You know, a lot of the users that I work with, they want to sign 10-year leases, while operators typically want to sign 5. So there's that balance there, but they want long-term homes for themselves. They don't want to go find new sites every 5 years, because they also know rents are going to probably grow at 5 years, right? So they want to lock those leases down. And so as an investor, what I want to make sure of is that I have an asset that for the long term, it will be a good home for that user.
So what does the future look like 5 or 10 years down the road?
I think there's going to be continued aggregation in the space. I think, you know, there's talks about sovereign wealth funds getting into the space. You're going to see more recaps from these operators. Maybe you won't see as many trade fully. Maybe, you know, it'll be one institutional investor buying out another institutional investor with that operator staying in place. Maybe you'll see a couple more REITs enter the space like Peakstone did last year. I think you're going to continue to see the aggregation and the movement of these portfolios one way from a complete sale to a recap, and larger institutional players getting involved.
So kind of tackling our second final four question that we always like to ask is, you know, what advice would you give to a young Andrew who might be getting involved in real estate, or just some life advice in general?
Pick one thing and stick at it. You know, become an expert in that one thing. You know, I would say early on, whenever I was doing just any kind of industrial, I was up in Lake Forest knocking on all these doors in Lake County, anywhere between 10,000 to 100,000 square feet. And I was just calling on anything. It wasn't until I specialized in this type of asset, understanding, you know, all the different users for this one type of asset, is when I became, you know, an expert, so to speak, at it. And I could speak educatedly about it. So I would say for anybody getting into real estate or just any kind of career, just become a specialist at that one specific thing.
Yeah, niching down is important. One of the ways that we also find a lot of value and importance is kind of looking at others' perspectives on the world. That's one of the reasons why we have this podcast. And one of the ways we do that, not through podcasting, is through books. And I'm curious if there's somebody who's interested in real estate, what book they should pick up next.
I'll be honest. I don't know when the last time I finished a book. I have a tendency to start and not finish.
That's still reading. You're just not finishing.
It's still reading. I would say lately, though, over the last couple of years, I've been really into podcasts. I've been, you know, when I moved to Dallas, one of the things I did that I thought was very helpful for me entering a new market or re-entering this market was to listen to local real estate professionals in my market on a podcast. And one was Jeremy Mercer and the Matador podcast, The Industrialist, where he brings on a number of brokers in our market. So when I moved here, I started listening to Jeremy's podcast, and he had every single market specialist on his podcast. And I learned the market that way. And I thought that was very helpful. You know, Kyle Matthews has his own podcast. Chris Powers has another. So I listen to all of those because I think, you know, even when it's not a real estate professional on their podcast, they bring different viewpoints that maybe I have never even thought about before. So that's been helpful for me.
Those are great, and those are all great podcasts. I'm less familiar with the Matador, but I'm very familiar with the Matthews and the Fort. So, in terms of that, you know, those are all great names, but is there anyone else influencing the world of real estate that we should have on the podcast next?
You know who I would love for you to have on the podcast? I don't know if it would be possible, but Brad Jacobs at QXO.
Okay.
And what
he's
done,
I'm familiar with him. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, with XPO, with United Rentals, with Waste Management, you know, all these, those users, all the businesses that he's helped build are iOS users. So I would love to know from, you know, the gentleman that created all of these companies or expanded all of these companies, how he sees our asset class. I think that would be a really good podcast to have.
Probably outdated. That's how most professionals outside of real estate hop on here. And that's the whole reason why we have this podcast, to learn and grow. If somebody wants to learn and grow by reaching out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
Call my cell phone. I'm pretty responsive on my cell phone. Shoot me an email. Happy to talk to anybody about industrial outdoor storage or real estate or life in general.
Andrew, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today, and we have to have you on in the future.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it, and thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Andrew. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.